we all already started through our introductions. And right now, my name is Tyler Gil Jones. Do we want to just go around again? Who's here?
Okay.
I'm Lay.
Barbara Ransley.
That means the woman and Jeff
Fuller. My name is Kate Josephson.
Are you a student?
No.
What I was in the process of doing was basically critiquing the program and the way it had been put together, and you know, calling into question, you know, who is here speaking, and the underlying assumption. I don't know if you were here this morning, but basically I was saying how, you know, you have this juxtaposition of speakers, and the only thing that they really have in common is that they're women. But there was no attempt to have any kind of like unity based along ideological lines or any kind of theme that was, you know, running throughout the workshops. And I was also talking about the credentials of the people that are on the, for leading the discussions, and that, you know, there was no attempt to incorporate community activists or workers and have their point of view brought across, which is, you know, I mean, sort of furthering the elitism that's implicit in most academic institutions. So I just wanted to, you know, throw that out, and, you know, like I said, I wanted to question what is the responsibility of an academic institution like this, and to what extent, if any, does an all-women's college differ in its thrust from an all, you know, both of them sort of become the perpetuators of the status quo, and in no way provide any kind of means of questioning. And you know, I mean, I think that the I think that all sort of like plays into establishing basically an apolitical consciousness of, among the people that attend these institutions, because, you know, we have a, like I said, we are located in Harlem here, Barnard, but there's a very low turnout by Black and other women of color. And it's not only that their perspective is missing and that their physical bodies are missing, but also in this whole area, it's been so gentrified that, you know, basically people don't even come in contact with Black people at all. And the only contact that they do, even though, you know, they're surrounded, I mean, the people that work here at this institution are primarily Black and Latino women, the women that work in clerical and service capacities. But people just sort of walk by them and take them for granted, you know, like they're there to serve, not even bothering to like say hi to them or anything. And then you see people on the street, you know, a lot of times there's women out there with their families or on the train. I saw a woman who was a single mother with two children going through the subway cars, you know, asking for money. You know, and that's the kind of like perception that people develop about Black people and the kind of limited interaction. That sort of brings me to this whole notion too of like this, the concept, the nouveau concept of the feminization of poverty, which of course, you know, is not a new concept or a phenomenon, that women of color have always been poor. But now that you find that the divorce rate is increasing among the middle class, all of a sudden, you know, it's like this new phenomenon is coined, and there's this attention being focused on it. So I just thought it was important as an organizer, and as someone who, you know, has organized conferences myself, to sort of like share my observations about how I would have organized this conference and how I would have done it a little bit differently, and the kinds of things that I think it's important for people to be sensitive to. Like I said before you came in, I've done organizing within all Black coalitions and multiracial coalitions, and I just wanted to bring up very briefly what I think some of the issues are facing, the challenges facing people who do organizing within multiracial coalitions. I think that the question of power is a key one. I think that we have to define and understand what we mean by Black leadership, that Black leadership is not just a Black face in a position, but it's a perspective and it's an identification with the oppressed and an understanding of that experience that comes from firsthand, because as victims of racism, we bring to any struggle our experience, and I think that experience then sets a tone for any organization that we're a part of. So therefore, I feel it is very important for organizations, particularly ones which are struggling against racism or apartheid, to have black leadership. I think that the other thing that comes into question too is that, because there's a lot of debate often about separate organizations versus multiracial organizations, and I think in a way it's sort of a false dichotomy that's set up, that either you work in multiracial coalitions or you work in separate organizations. And I think that there is a place and a significance for both. And I think that both have to exist. But oftentimes you find people, for example, who work in all, like, let's say, black coalitions, just totally disregarding the significance of working within multiracial coalitions. One of the reasons why I think that multiracial coalitions are important is because I feel that in order for there to be a successful anti-racist struggle in this country, you're going to have the participation of whites and of course other people of color. But along those lines too, I think that one has to define what the role is that whites will play in that struggle and develop some sort of structure within your organization. Which becomes then representative of the ideology that you're espousing. I think that separate organizations, all white organizations, what I'm referring to in particular, if you just tell whites, go and organize among yourself, you're failing to address the issue of power. You're failing to address the issue of who, by and large, has the better resources, or let's say the access to better resources. And I think that, you know, it's important to make white students feel, number one, that they have something involved in the struggle against racism. This is not just a charity thing. It's not something just based on a moral position, you know, that they should get involved in because they feel guilty, but because they're fundamentally committed to changing the structure and organization of the society, that they see injustice in the society that aren't just along racial lines, but also along a class line. For me, for example, as a black person, I would be no more satisfied that, you know, if the society today, if white people and black people were reversed in their situation in the society, because that still, to me, there would be oppression, you know, and it's just who was getting oppressed. So I relate to it not only on racial lines, but class lines and analyze oppression through those filters. Like I said, I think that multiracial organizations allow for a structural context in which racism is analyzed and confronted, as opposed to an all-white organization where basically racism then becomes relegated to some sort of abstraction. You know, I think also that this idea that whites can lead an anti-racist struggle sort of plays into this paternalistic view that whites are in any position to educate other people without having been directed or receiving leadership from black people about racism. You know, and to me that's a pretty ludicrous idea. I don't think that one develops a consciousness about racism merely from reading, because we have found, you know, in our organization especially, I mean, you have people who think they have some sort of theoretical understanding, but then when it comes to racism, you know, on a personal level, you know, that's rampant, you know, but they're not aware of it, you know, and I think that that's something. So anyway, those are basically some of the things that I wanted to throw out there and things that we could think about talking about.
Okay, basically. And I know it shows the program. And basically, I would like just to give a brief background on my student activism. First, I'm South African, and I organized at home, student level, community level. And the basic thing that I think is important to me, and it always has been, is that the students need to understand they can organize on their own. And I see that here they have student organizing. I don't believe that students belong to campuses. I think they are part of a community. There's a larger community outside that they need to be a part of. And more often than not, we find students divorcing themselves from larger issues that concern the people. They look at them as if they belong to them, and I am one of the people who is guilty of the same thing. And I'm sure a lot of us are guilty of that, because we tend to talk in terms of them and us. Okay, and I think that needs to be eliminated. And so, coming in South Africa, I worked within student ranks where the black students organized on their own because of the situation. We had to organize on black campuses because that's where we were there. We were not allowed to interact with the students. And our group of students, we came after the Black Consciousness Movement, and which meant that there had already been a break between the black and white student coalition, based on the fact that the white students talked about the need to end racism, but not making a concerted effort to actually end it. And there's a very good example that I always use. The white students at the University of Natal formed this group of organization which was multiracial, or I don't know whether it was multiracial or not, but were different races. No, the reason why I don't want to say it's multiracial, the one that many blacks and white students. So they went to the university, they had a conference at the University of Rhodes University, which is another white university. The white students left with the black students from the University of Natal, from segregated sort of dorms, to the University of Rhodes University, not letting them know that we are going to be accommodated on campus with all the other students. We are going to dump you in some other church. These were students who felt that they believed in the same principles, who talked against racism on a daily basis. So those kinds of things, those are the little things that really bother me, and I think those are the things that we need to look at. And coming to Colombia, I found myself involved in the Coalition for a Free Southern Africa, which to me still has a place somewhere in my student activism, in my organizing. And where there were black and white students, and we had a series of problems. White students, black students, not really being on the same, operating from the same wavelength. And the issue that Tanika talked about in terms of leadership, who should be in leadership in terms of the anti-apartheid movement or the struggle against racism. I basically believe that what she said is very, very crucial, and I think it's the biggest problem. That's why I asked you about Rutgers. I didn't even know that there's an anti-apartheid movement going on at Rutgers, because there was a huge split, and I don't know if it was healed. And I don't know who's organizing now, because the white student felt they needed to organize it, and the black student felt they needed to organize it, and they never came together. But I think at Columbia, we sort of resolved it, because the white student understood, and after a series, I don't know if we fully understand both groups, but we've come to a realization that, you know, it is the truth, and we need to understand why it is necessary for the black students to be in leadership, because of the constant denial for self-determination for black people all over the world, wherever they are. Whatever, if they are quote-unquote free, they always have the Britain and the United States hanging up as being the very people ruling them. So they are never free to rule themselves. So that's the way I look at it. There are no black people anywhere in this world I regard as free. I think if they have some kind of illusion that they are ruling, the fact that they depend on the West or the East makes them bound to those leaders. So I also now am involved with student organizing of the black student. I think it's very important that I explain why it happened. We were at a conference at Hunter College, and the black student. There was a program just like this one. When I looked at it, it reminded me of the student conference, where there were issues about South Africa, but nothing was talked about in terms of racism that seemed to be the inherent problem everywhere throughout the country. And nothing was decided by black students. The white students were in total control of everything. And ACOA was also in control. They had set out the agenda and everything. And we started questioning it as black students. Like, it's like we don't have a role in this whole conference. And we decided we were going to have a black caucus. Still, when we asked them before the conference, because they sent us the program before the day. When we asked for a day, they slaughtered us during dinner time. It's like no one else, it doesn't matter. They had to be some, you had to find some time for you, which we thought was really a little bit presumptuous for ACOA. They should have made a slot or had a workshop on racism that was going to give us a chance to talk about the things that we thought were wrong. So we had that caucus, which indeed gave birth to the National African Youth Student Alliance, which I'm a part of. And basically, the black students trying to grapple with the problems that they find on black or white campuses in the community. And our main thing is to go and work within the community. And I basically feel that the people in the community would react much, much more different if I talk to them than if you talk to them. Because the society is so polarized to the extent that there is no direct interaction that Tanake was talking about. Here on campus, we go to coalition meetings. We are there for 2 hours. When we meet in the streets, we don't talk, okay? We don't greet each other, the white student and the black student. And this I've seen even in my classrooms. We are with students, we have a project, we work together. When we meet in the hallways, we don't talk to each other. So there's no direct interactions. The black student even find that thing translated among themselves. We find that the black students don't even talk. So what's going on? We need to look at those problems as to why is it that the black and white students cannot talk? How can we expect a miracle of them being able to organize when they can't even talk? Maybe, in my opinion, if the black students came together and tried to thresh out what their common problems are, right, there will be some kind of example. And I find it very difficult to understand people who feel the white black student cannot come together. In each and every campus I've been, there is a black student organization. Right? That's why I think there's a basic need for the black student to come across and understand their basic history, things that they have in common, because a lot of us haven't been taught anything that has something to do with our background. Wherever we've been, and I'm talking about South Africa as well, the curriculum has been Eurocentric. Most of the things have nothing. We have no black images that are positive. They do not portray anything about black people that is positive, and we need to come together and thresh it out. And I think that's why we chose to go and work in the community and addressing the problems that seem to bother the black people within the community, and form a core group of people who will be willing to work and try and thresh or organize around the community, black community, and come out with a core group of people who will be willing to set up programs that will thresh out the problems that I think the white establishment have failed to combat, and that is the truth. And in terms of student organizing, I think the students need to understand that the struggle doesn't start when I come to college. If it took that up until that time for me to be a student activist, it shouldn't end after 4 years or after 6 years. It has to go beyond beyond that that period, and also if there are problems that make students activists, for instance, anti-apartheid, it shouldn't be a seasonal kind of program. It shouldn't be a fad. It shouldn't be involved. It should be something that teaches us, that can be used to teach us to look at inherent problems that confront us, which stem out of institutionalized racism. Because as far as I'm concerned, it is not just racism per se. It is institutionalized racism that has to do with the mind that has been distorted from when one has been that small. And that goes for both blacks and whites. The whites have been told that they are superior, and the blacks have been told that they are inferior. We need to get out of that kind of thinking and see if we can work things out for a better society. And I don't know if I agree with Tanke in terms of whites not being able to work in their communities. I basically believe it's very, very important for whites who feel that they are conscious enough and they've conquered their racism to be role models and come up with programs that can be used in white communities and try to conscientize the young white students, because whether we like it or not, in South Africa we have segregated. It's segregated by law, but here I still find the communities segregated. Whether we like it or not, the white students live in white communities and the black students live in black communities. If that wasn't the case, we wouldn't have cases like Howard Beach, for instance. We wouldn't have Westchester County, which is almost newly white. So I think whether we like it or not, if the black white students have to work in black communities, they have to travel from their communities to the black communities, and they will be regarded as aliens. And the black students, if they were to go and work in white communities, they will be regarded as aliens. So we need to understand why there is such a problem and how can we combat it. And maybe just to...
Denise, can I just clarify my point? Mm. I didn't say that whites shouldn't organize within their communities. I said that I think that they should, but that they have to get their direction and leadership from blacks in order to be able to do that. They can't just by themselves decide that they're going to go out and educate people about racism, and they haven't really had an opportunity to be in any kind of organization which made them personally confront their own racism.
Okay, which brings me to my closing remarks. My basic feeling, I basically feel that there are a lot of people of color in this country who are subjugated, who are being oppressed, who have no power. They are powerless, just like the black leaders. And I think I am not best qualified to organize within the Latino community. Because of institutionalized racism, we have been demarcated. Okay? And if there is a good Latino role model, I think they can organize better. And I think if the whites and the blacks and the Latinos and everybody worked vigorously to eradicate racism in our communities where we find ourselves, and then later on after we build the organizations and we are strong enough, come into coalition. That is the only time that I think coalitions will work. If we come on with, in my opinion, from experience, if we come up not understanding, and I can buy what Tanaka is saying, maybe we can be able to share things. But this has to be internal, and I think it has to be personal. People need to understand that there's something wrong, because there are people who will talk about racism in South Africa and not want to deal with the racism in the United States. And then that means that they basically feel that since we have the Declaration of Independence and that constitution, there are no problems in the United States. Or maybe they will just dismiss them and say, we have some problems, but they are not that bad. And that makes us not deal with the problem. And I think the students can help, because we are congregated, we are a lot at campuses at one stage or another, or at any stage or another. So we need to use that as a springboard to deal with the problems that are there. Otherwise, coalitions will be an illusion. Thank you.
Okay, I'm trying to edit out some of the things that have already been said before.
This is also sort of there seems to be only six of us, and maybe you could, I don't mind if people interject comments or something. I did sort of,
You have a question already?
No, I'm
Right.
Question about these pieces of paper. Okay, well, let me just introduce myself. I'm from the University of Michigan. I'm a graduate student in the History Department. I teach women's studies in Afro-American history. I'm a student and a teacher. I grew up in a black community in Detroit. Started doing political work as a teenager, and so for the past 13 or 14 years, I've done different kinds of anti-racist political work. Most recently, I've worked in the South African movement. So I just sort of want to frame my approach to the workshop, which is to say, you know, I guess maybe we should have talked about this. You know, I think maybe if we had advertised the workshop differently, we might have gotten more. Yeah, because it sort of, it says student organize, and really what we're talking about is, I mean, all three of us are talking about problems of racism within a larger student movement. We probably should have said that, you know, racism within the movement or something like this, because that is part of what I want to address. The way I see it connected is, you know, I mean, that has historically been one of the issues that have divided progressive movements. You know, racism, how people should organize, you know, whether people should organize separately or in coalitions, problems within coalitions, problems with organizing separately. All these issues which we're addressing. So that's why we see it as connected, and it's also a problem within the women's movement, a very big problem, which we see demonstrated today. So that's why racism is a big issue in this workshop, in case anybody was wondering. And the other thing, which we've already talked about, is part of understanding a black feminist perspective is understanding a holistic approach toward oppression. I think black women in particular have been asked by various groups of allies to dissect our oppression. You know, you're either black or you're a woman or you're a worker. And, you know, part of, I think, the usefulness in some of bell hooks's more recent work, although earlier work is troublesome, is that, you know, she tries to suggest, and I guess we'll get back to this coalition versus separate thing again, but she tries to suggest that black women, that the experience is so important that black women are not only important as leaders of the black community, but the entire community, because once you, I mean, sort of like that Gil Scott-Heron album, you know, it's like once this group starts asking for freedom, and once this group starts asking for freedom, pretty soon the whole damn world will be asking for freedom. And one of the things which is a source of both strength and frustration, you know, for black women in this country is that we embody, you know, so many levels of oppression in this society, economic oppression, racial oppression, gender oppression, that once black women start to put their issue and their analysis on the table, you really are talking about a revolutionary agenda. I mean, you're talking about radically changing society. And I think that's something that not only the black community has to come to grips with, but anybody calling themselves agents of social change, you know, have to look to, that within our experience as oppressed people, there is such a large agenda that if we really do our work in terms of analyzing that oppression, you know, we're talking about something that will fundamentally change the society we live in. So I think that people who haven't had that experience, if they only try to define their own oppression or their support of, that we do have the, you know, the likelihood of falling into either missionaryism or a very limited agenda. If it's only a white women's movement, then it's the least common denominator phenomena where you have, we're all oppressed by rape. You know, I mean, rape is an oppressive, you know, issue of oppression for all women. So that becomes the key issue, as opposed to having another approach that says, look at the most oppressed group for a genuine agenda for liberation, which means you got to include a whole lot of other issues. So when you start talking about including black women, it doesn't just mean, you know, those things that are common to black and white. It means a total agenda for that most oppressed group. And, you know, it gets difficult and scary for some people, but I think that's the important challenge. So that's just, you know, sort of where I'm coming from with that. So with that approach in mind, I think, you know, I just want to say some specific things about what I think is going on in the campuses now. You know, I think we've seen a genuine right-wing trend in the country, which is characterized by, you know, three things, which historically moves toward fascism, which I see happening. I see fascism and other forms of government as really being on a continuum, and we can have more or less features of them at any point in time, but see a move toward fascism, which is characterized by increased racism, increased militarism, and increased misogyny. We see the right to life movement talking about you know, no reproductive rights for women. At the same time, you know, increasing the military budget and justifying, legitimizing violent racist attacks on people of color throughout the country. That's an issue that is, you know, reflected on the campuses as well, increased racial attacks on the campuses, erosion of students of color access to campuses, you know, also attacks on feminist movements on campus and increased military budgets on campus. More and more money going toward the military as opposed to the most, you know, needy groups on campus and in society. So the kinds of, unfortunately, the kinds of movements that have developed have been sort of single issue movements and, you know, either a very narrow definition of racism or a very narrow definition of sexism or a very narrow definition of the peace movement and anti-war stuff. And I think, you know, when we do start to look to the most oppressed as leaders of the entire movement, we get beyond these narrow single issue kinds of campaigns. We have to, and I think also it's important to say, you know, in the same vein that I think, you know, I don't believe that every woman is my sister, and you know, I just don't. And you know, along the same lines, I don't think that every black man is my brother. I mean, Clarence Pendleton, for example, is, we have to base our politics on our. Oh, Clarence Pendleton's very conservative black man in the Reagan administration. You know, has been personified sellout for the black community. I mean, we see that phenomenon in South Africa and other places. So our genes don't, you know, our politics aren't ahead, they're not in our genes, and we have to struggle constantly, you know, around that issue, I think. In fact, the easiest person to get to sort of, you know, spy or sell out is, you know, in a women's conference, you know, a radical feminist perspective coming from a woman, you're not going to have a man come in and give it. So I think we have to get beyond these narrow single issue things. But I think that doesn't take women of color, again, out of central focus. Like, I don't think, for example, it's narrow to say that the liberation of women of color has to be central to any progressive student movement. I don't think, and people say, well, that's a special interest thing. I mean, there's a minority group, a real minority group. But I think, again, you know, back to the whole notion that if you get to the root of the problem, you know, everything layered on top of that is going to have to be challenged. That you know, we can see that as being essential. In that context, the black feminist theory of social change and of liberation, I think, is key, both for students and others. Then I just want to talk about some other specific things on campus in terms of hierarchies on campus and how we divide ourselves. And I think another thing that can be learned from an Afrocentric approach to teaching and learning and will move us toward a genuinely, you know, a genuine sort of pedagogy of liberation and feminist pedagogy. An approach to knowledge and an approach to learning, which is fundamentally liberating, is that we stop dichotomizing our roles. I think we're all teachers and students. But what we have on the campus, we have the students organized, and then we have the teachers coming in for the teach-ins and being the experts. Whereas in the black community, I mean, it's always been a give and take between, you know, children, for example, who had a chance to go to school, coming home and teaching grandparents how to read at night, but never challenging the authority or the wisdom of those grandparents at the same time. So being a teacher doesn't mean being the more powerful. So I think, you know, breaking down those barriers are very concepts of knowledge acquisition in the elitist institution has to be changed. And also, you know, just like, I mean, I think, you know, this was touched upon too, like where we see the credentials. Like, why is it that, I mean, if you live in a racist society, why is it that people with PhDs are the only people who have the credentials to teach? I mean, there's women in the community who have experiences that students at Barnard can learn a tremendous amount from. Those people aren't brought in. You know, women's caucuses on campus and fighting the struggle in Michigan now, you know, don't think of including issues that are of concern to the women who clean up those offices at night. You know, who really, again, you're talking about that's the most oppressed group on campus. You know, it's not whether, it's not whether you have 3 or 4 women's studies courses, which is really the key issue causing suffering for women, although it is an important issue. You know, you have women who are trying to, support 4 kids on $10,000 a year and no health benefits. I mean, compassion for women means compassion for that kind of suffering. So breaking down those barriers and thinking of not organizing just within comfortable middle class intellectual circles, but beyond. I'll skip some of these examples. So at the same time, I think, despite all these problems, I think there is a real potential for organizing progressive student movement, keeping certain lessons in mind from the past. I think the anti-apartheid movement generated a lot of energy among students. Upsurge in racist attacks recently has elicited a militant, serious response, particularly from the Black community. And, I think, in Michigan we had a woman come and talk about Black feminist theory, and we had a room for about 50 people. And we had to move to an auditorium because, there was just this hunger for a real synthesis of these various, models of oppression. So I think, there's reasons for optimism. And I also think, again, when we're talking about who's going to lead, the people who, I think of people like my grandmother who never learned to read, very oppressed in many ways. She never had the luxury to be cynical. You see, sort of leftover activists from the 60s who are now have comfortable jobs, and they're cynical. If you have a society that's basically trying to destroy you, cynicism is a luxury. You've got to be optimistic on just about every level of your life. So I think that's something else embodied in the experience of Black people and Black women in this country is a certain resilience that allows one to bounce back from defeats and allows one to persevere in times when things don't look so wonderful. So that's another thing about that leadership that comes from an experience of oppression. So I'm optimistic, and I think there's things that can be done. Just to sort of enumerate those, and then maybe can have a little discussion, I guess. I think the importance of Black and Third World leadership is critical. We don't think of a women's movement led by men, so I don't know if we can think of an anti-racist movement or even a progressive movement not led by those people who are the fundamental victims of oppression in this kind of society. So I think that's important. And I also think, though, I think that multiracial movement and coalitions are, in fact, important. Now, in different contexts, I think you have to examine whatever local situation you find yourself in, whether it's feasible. On some campuses, maybe it's not feasible given a political history in some communities. But I find in a number of situations I've been in, it is, in fact, possible and feasible. And I think I find there's a certain arrogance in some white activists who will support separate organizing from a distance because although on a certain level they're organizing within their communities, they haven't taken the leadership from the people who really have the source of the answer, I think, And so, I think there needs to be those role models, but I think probably really conquering racism means to challenge those people to also accept Black women as role models. And when you start to do that, if that's possible, I think some things really start to break down because I've seen all white organizations, I'll mention the National Lawyers Guild, which considers itself a radical organization on certain levels, and it supports, separate organizing, but is so comfortable with white male leadership. It's like, oh yeah, please, don't come into our organization and demand to be leaders. We can support you from afar. People say this thing about, if you have your own house, it's like if a white organization is set up, Black people coming in, it's always as junior partners. And that's a problem, I think. So there's always a need for new formations for that reason. And I think that Black people have to initiate those things. On the other hand, if somebody comes into your house and they just sort of find a little niche, that's one thing, then you're still in control. They come in and they start changing shit around and like knocking down walls and creating new rooms and really making the whole architecture different. then that's something else. And I think, so it means white people giving up some power, which I think,
They're not ready to.
Yeah, I think we have to make them ready.
Because
it becomes getting off the hook, I think, in a way, otherwise. Anyway, so, and the other thing is I think they have to be student worker alliances to break down that elitism. It has to be a feminist agenda within both black organizations and multiracial coalitions. I think, for example, if we had a Fannie Lou Hamer or an Ella Baker leading the civil rights movement slash black, you know, the early part of the black liberation movement, because I think there were two significant phases, I think that movement would have gotten more radical quicker than Martin Luther King. And what else? Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much it. And then we have to get beyond the sort of single issue politics and really think much more broader in terms of challenging structures and not just, you know, faces and facades. So, I mean, once we start to push for those things, I don't know. I mean, I think you're never going to win everybody to it, you know, but if you try to win a core, I mean, even at the height of any revolutionary movement, the majority of people are not determining the agenda. It's always a core. So if you can win a core of people to that, and a larger number to accepting certain levels of it, I think there's a potential for fundamental change. So. That was a little scattered, but.
Maybe just to end on, I think that's a very important point, because when I talk about any kinds of feminism within the black community, they look at it as white. They don't want to deal with it because they basically believe that it's an extension of racism. The white feminists look at feminism as it pertains to them. They will not look at it beyond anything. Like, so I always give the example, like, they are trying to fight to get 100,000 that their white male counterpart is making. And then the black woman is trying to fight to get a job. Right. So how can they sort of sit on this same table, discuss the same issues, when their agendas are different? So maybe that's what is important in your presentation. Yeah. We need to look at we needn't look at the lowest common denominator, but the whole. And that's a very important point.
From what all of you said, it was saying, I just started this year, 2 months ago, transferring to London. And one of the biggest issues on our campus right now, as on a lot of college campuses, is racism. And just last week, Audre Lorde came to speak, give a lecture, and then a workshop, of which I was both. And she started out her lecture saying, I'm tired of talking to white people about racism, go out and educate yourselves, because I'm just sick of it. That's fine, so she asked to come to Smith. that's an attitude, I can understand that, I can put it into a perspective, and that's fine with me. She's right, at some point, I think white people have to go out and make some sort of an effort to understand, because we'll never experience a black person's experience. But then what I think, at least you said, is that that whites can't go out and organize themselves towards racism. And so, another example, at Smith, we have various programs, one of which is racial awareness workshops that are required of all the houses.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's one of our demands now.
We haven't had one in my house yet this year, but it should be coming up sometime soon. And I know from the other workshops, we have lesbian awareness workshops and we have rape awareness workshops, and they're really good. And so I would imagine that the racial awareness are going to
anticipate.
Yeah, well, this is my point. Yes, they are. And I asked, and that came up in the workshop with Audre Lorde, and I asked, or somehow it came up, somebody said, why aren't there white people doing it? If you're talking, we have 82, okay, I think the number is 82 black students on Smith College campus. We have 8% minorities. Okay, that's just a problem itself.
What's the percentage of black students?
There are 82.
Out of how much population?
2,500. No, okay, so that's like its own, that's an issue,
it's
a major issue in itself.
It's better, the last time I went to Smith, there were fewer than that.
Right, that's a real problem, which is, but what I'm saying is, this workshop, I said, or somebody said, I can't remember, if you're saying to us, if the women of color in the group were saying to the white women, and Audre Lorde was saying to the white women, why don't you go out and educate yourself? Why weren't there any white women doing these racial awareness workshops? And because I would be more than happy to. I would like to. And they said it's against the system, that our system doesn't allow it. Like, what system? The Smith College system is based on student government. I mean, it's a student governing school, supposedly. And so it's against the system. I mean, how do you feel about having white students doing racial awareness workshops? And then how do you feel about, if you don't want them to, then at what point, I mean, again, when I get back after spring break, friends of mine and I are starting a white awareness, white racial awareness discussion group, because there's such conflict and animosity between the very few black students and the very large white students. But if that's not the answer, what is the answer? I mean, how do you eradicate something like this? How does a student, from my perspective, going into a campus where last writing nasty things on the black girls' doors? I mean, you have all those problems, and it seems like such a waste of our energy. We should get over it. We should come together and do something else, I don't know, project all get rid of our conflicts in such a small environment and get our energies together and go somewhere else with it.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, what you were saying is it's still difficult to put black and white working together. But I don't think that, you know, the solution is, and first of all, I mean, Audre Lorde has her opinion, I have mine.
Right.
And there's no, like, one set black opinion.
Right.
On what the correct way to organize is.
Neither is the
right. Yeah. So, you know,
I know, I'm just asking your opinion.
No, so I'm just saying, though, that I think, I mean, I would be all in favor of, I think it should be led by women of color. I think
what? The racial awareness workshop?
Yeah. Because, and I'm not saying that, you know, I mean, that whites couldn't at some juncture, leading such a workshop, but oftentimes, I mean, it's really hard to find whites that have that kind of awareness that's necessary, and the expertise that's necessary. I think that one of the most important things that happened during my blockade, which is really a new experience for a lot of students here at Columbia, is that almost like 95% of the speakers that we had in the room were black. And that was the first time that a lot of these white students who went to this school actually listen to the black perspective, you know, and I think that, you know, as far as the, so I think that it's important for that reason too, just to, you know, because I don't think there's that many opportunities for blacks to voice their opinions and have their opinions listened to. I mean, certainly when you go to school, there's not going to be very many black teachers you have, you know, so I think that you're not, you may probably not very many black friends you're going to have, so I think that's very important. But on the other hand, I think that, like, the difficulties you're having with the black students, I think that the group of women who have some sort of race consciousness and should try to come to an understanding of what is it that the black women, not to say they shouldn't have a right to also meet by themselves, I think that they should, but I think that you also should make an effort to try to understand what it is that's bothering them and how you can maybe restructure the organization in some kind of way or redefine things so that there can be participation by black and white people. What I've found, though, a lot of times is even like let's say you're in a group of people, and we've had like many conferences in the anti-apartheid movement talking specifically about racism in the movement. And then you get with these students and they think that, see, you may think you have a race consciousness about it, but that's not really, you're not really sure, can't assess that independently. That has to come also from what black people feel is your level of consciousness about your own racism. Because, you know, it's just like with men. I mean, men are, you're raised inconsistent, which is inherently racist and sexist. And you have to struggle all your life as a man to rid yourself of it. And I think that the same is true. So I just think that people, you know, like I said, I think that you should try to approach them and find out what the difficulties are. And then, you know, like I was going to say, that we've been to a lot of conferences and this is why students, and that even these people who consider themselves really aware are not able to come to, first of all, accept legitimate criticism of their own racism. We will be there as black students telling them what we feel is racist, and they will be get very, very defensive.
Right.
You know, and feel like, you know, like, you know, because it's painful. Yeah. But right. It may be painful for you to hear it, but right. It's more painful for black people who are actually dying as a consequence right. of racism. You know, and people I don't think really have an understanding of that, really understand the kind of relentless onslaught of racism that people of color have to go through in society, day in and day out. It's a luxury. A white person can decide to deal with racism or doesn't have to deal with racism. Black people do not have that choice. They have to. And I think that if there's that kind of understanding and willingness to understand the kind of issues there, you know, I think that it can be. You know, like I said, we've been a lot of times in Dallas, you seem to get defensive, but even some of the organizers there who have been organizing for a long time in anti-racist context won't even intercede and say, look, as a white person who's been involved in this struggle for a long time, I, you know, let me try to bridge some of the gaps in the development. They'll sit there quietly too, because they feel that they're being persecuted.
But
you know, I think there is a will,
there's
a way.
There are no answers. I don't think there are easy answers. Mm-hmm. There are answers, but not a lot. Because basically, you find that I went to St. Lawrence. They had the same problem that you have at Smith. And on the day I spoke, everything just sort of popped out. Because I gave them the scenario of Columbia. And they have a coalition of every student group that is not based on race, okay? And so, unfortunately, they never communicated. There was no trust, no understanding of basic points of departure. And all of a sudden, I made them understand that it's not only their problem, but it's a global problem. We need to understand it. We need to know that we cannot just work on coalition but not interact on an ongoing process. It doesn't work that way. And I want, I need to understand that I can trust that there's a basic understanding that we can deal with issues, yeah. Not just this, but on general.
I understand that.
Yeah, I was just thinking that, you know, both Tanakil and Tanisha were talking, you know, it's, when you think of, see, I think we always have to talk about what we're talking about. I think we can't be too simplistic about, you know, I mean, when we say black people should give leadership, it doesn't mean that white people shouldn't do it. You know, it doesn't mean that, you know, people should just sit. And so I think that whites can't be passive about it. So in certain situations, I think it might be okay for a white person to lead a discussion on racism or something like that. But we're talking about a lot, but then we're talking about a movement that is the legwork of implementing a movement, is leading discussions, is giving talks, is doing all these things, and I think white people have to do those things. But we're talking in a bigger sense about building a movement, where should the direction and leadership of that movement come from? And I think if you don't have some kind of ongoing coalition work and organizational work that involves, that brings white people into contact with black leaders, that two problems develop. One is that you have two movements. The reality is that you will have on a campus, if white students trying to organize racism, they don't have black leaders, you're going to have a white-led movement, and that's going to be the one that's going to get the media coverage, it's going to get the recognition from the administration. So I don't think, you know, so I think that within that, there has to be black leadership, so that makes it multiracial. And then the other thing that happens, you know, is that part of understanding racism is not just the it's not just talking theoretically about things, it's giving us. It's giving up privilege and power and turning the tables and saying that because this society says we're supposed to be at the center of everything, you know, as progressives and people who want social change, we're going to reverse that. And we're going to say let another experience be at the center. Because
you know, if these are the people who are in the margins because of oppression, they have to be at the center in terms of liberation. So it's teaching black, white people through work that, you know, white supremacy is not something that can in any way be a part of a consciousness of a progressive. So it means, you know, so I mean, I think for you to teach, you know, a session on, you know, in and of itself, that's fine. You know, if there's, what if you didn't have any black people on campus? Then somebody would have to do it, right? I mean, like, you know, Denise is talking about in South Africa. Physically, people are separate, so what can you do? But as a principal, I think whenever possible, we have to strive to have that leadership be, you know. So that's
another thing that I think we need to look at. Basically, the society is so structured that white people always tell black people what is wrong.
Right.
And we react ferociously against it when you have, even if we know that is wrong, we feel you have no right to tell us what is wrong. We feel we have the right to explain why we feel it is wrong. Because it's not just enough to say, that's wrong, but what are you doing about trying to fix it? And I know a lot of black students just don't want to listen when the white students try to tell them. They basically believe that they it should come from them. And I feel the same way about South Africa. I basically believe that all my life I've been told what is wrong and how they can fix it and how such reforms are necessary for me. I basically think that I can decide what is good for me. All right? Because I know the corners that really have made my life hell. And I know what out of that that I think is good and what is bad. No one has been telling me.
If I could just maybe ask a few questions.
Questions, sure.
I mean, if you want to make the decision before I ask. Can I just say one
thing? The other thing that I was going to say is that I think it would be a problem with the perception of the sincerity of our students.
Right.
Lot of times, like for example, let's say there's an incident occurred on the campus where white men put some kind of slur on a black woman's room. Instead of like organizing and saying, God, we're really outraged as white students, and then going and like trying to find out who the perpetrators are and confronting, when people just don't do anything. So then people start saying, well, if you're really sincere, you know, what are you doing to show your outrage about this?
Right.
And that's where I think that a lot of problems come in.
Yep.
But anyway.
I guess I've come to these conferences for a lot of years now. I mean, like not 20 years, say, for quite a while. And I, you know, I always have mixed feelings about them. This particular one, I mean, feminist and scholar. But one of the things, I guess, I felt again this morning, and I was glad that you talked about it. I'm sorry, I missed beginning of your discussion, was that there was an assumption of the audience being like academics or students. Even if people talk, and very much middle class, it's $25
right.
for people who aren't students or other
people.
Even if people talk about revolution, use the word revolution, or talk about conscientizing or whatever, nevertheless, it seems to me there is this assumption of who the audience is, and
yes.
Nothing comes up about stuff that's going on right now.
Right.
You know, politically, I mean, it's very unpolitical. It's women's studies. So feminism becomes women's studies.
Right.
Now, the thing is, I think the women's liberation movement really, I don't even want to say was, because I don't want to talk as if it's dead. I don't think it's dead. I think it's something that's very much alive. However, maybe in the sense that women may not call themselves feminists or women's liberationists, but they certainly are revolutionaries. But it certainly, at its inception, was a revolutionary movement that was challenging also the left. And I think in some ways the women's liberation movement in this country has really been stuck for quite a while. I mean, this dang question of having no relationship to working women, black women, you know, that's all there. But the thing, I guess, one of the things I felt like when the racists were raising for, you know, in the beginning of the movement was, for example, the question of the relationship of members of an organization to the leadership. Organization, what form should organizations take? How should they be structured? Now, in a sense, I felt like all of you were talking about organizing, but I think it's a really hard question, and I think the question of coalitions and different movements, one of the things that happens is there really is a break in the relationship of the people who make decisions so often, and whatever you want to call rank and file. And I think that's really a problem, and I think it's a problem in revolutions too. I think it's been a problem in revolutions. I work for the Marxist Humanist Organization, so I have a particular perspective.
Okay.
Here's a letter. He's like an article about it.
Yeah, no.
But I feel like it's hard, like it's a very important question. How, in other words, what does it mean to say you're a women's liberationist, or to say that you're struggling against racism, and to see yourself, to see that that means being revolutionary, and you're saying that you want nothing less, like you said, switching roles isn't going to do it. Or making an abstraction of unity or solidarity so that questions of class never come up, or whatever it is. What is the relationship to how you make decisions about what kind of organization you have, what relationships are within the organization, and where your ideas come from? Where do principles come from? How do you perceive? How do you carry, I feel like, and in a sense, the same question, it seems to me, came up, in a sense, in what you were saying. Also, I feel like so much is going on with students now in China, South Africa, and Mexico, and Spain, and on. And I think a lot of it does have to do with South Africa. I'm not saying there's a direct correlation, but whether you say something's in the air, So I guess I feel like leaving these other things, and I'm being abstract too, but I think it is a really important question that, in other words, it can't just be hit or miss. I think it is something that people work out in the course of the struggle, but I don't think it's just something, like the question of leadership that certainly from what I've been reading and following in terms of all of the anti-racist struggles in New York, there are a lot of black leaders, at least people who present themselves as leaders, who black people I know don't see as their leaders.
Being black doesn't mean that you're automatically your leadership is key, but it does mean that once you're on the right track, you have an experience that a comparable white person doesn't, and you're able to sustain a good direction of what you're trying to do.
Yeah, no, I'm not questioning that so much. I'm questioning that how the credential, in other words, is it on the basis of who's the peers? Is it on the basis of who's paid their dues, who longest been in struggle? And what is the relationship of the president?
Because
I think the present one too is a lot of the quote unquote leadership is being created by the community. And there's a national basis in the community or in your constituency. So I think that that's where there is a big credibility gap.
Right. And what you see coming up, for instance, in New York City, is that the community is beginning to question if these very leaders have a constituency that has something to do with the black people. And are they accountable to the black people? And I think more and more people are going to question as to, if you are a leader, what have you done in the community? And have you really been worried, for instance, David Dinkins, have you been worried about the fact that there are poor people in Harlem, and what have you done to alleviate that kind of thing? Have you really juxtaposed them with the people who are living in Midtown Manhattan on First Avenue? Those things are real, and the very people you say you are a leader of react to those things, and there is a clear distinction of the haves and have nots. And how do you react to both groups? And who really knocks the table for you, and who do you listen to more, the poor or the rich, and why is that?
Where are we here? 5 minutes to four.
Right. I have to go to another.
So is it right?
March 21st.
Okay.
Presentation.
I don't know.
Shop.